Okay, thank you for being here. I'm honored to be here, kicking off the library lecture series this spring. It's a really wonderful series that connects MSUB to the larger Billings and Eastern Montana communities. And it accomplishes something that's often missing in contemporary American society more broadly. And that is bridging the ideas and innovations of the academic world to people like you who are excited about new ways of thinking and rediscovering old ways of thinking, stories and histories that have been obscured, forgotten, but which bear on our current moment in important ways. So thank you for being here. And I'm also a kind of bridge between last fall's lecture series with its theme of monsters and Kelly McCoy's lecture next week, which is Red Fire Trucks and Big Mustaches, Reimagining Fire and Emergency Services in the Experience Age. And I'm going to talk about fire today in a more philosophical and historical way, but there's a connection nonetheless. So I should probably introduce myself a little more fully. As Tyree said, I teach in the Department of English, Philosophy, and Modern Languages here at MSUB. And I primarily teach American literature, but and as she said, environmental studies and Native American studies courses as well. And my scholarly focus is 19th century American literature. Think about Edgar Allan Poe, Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and those figures. And I'm happy to talk about Herman Melville after the lecture. My students are exhausted by this point. So we'll leave Melville off tonight's agenda, although he'll make one brief appearance. One great aspect of working in a small department in a university like MSUB is that I have the opportunity to teach a variety of courses in a variety of areas. Not just 19th century American literature, but environmental literature, literary theory, etc. And this allows me to trace broader patterns across national traditions, time periods, and forms of literary expression. So teaching introductory courses especially, courses that students take for gen ed credit and may not even want to be there, often don't want to be there, at least at first, that lets me consistently ask the most basic, the most obvious, and sometimes the most challenging questions. Questions like, what is literature? What is it good for? And why in 2019 should we read a 200-year-old novel instead of watching the news, a basketball game, or the Kardashians? And that question came up last week when I was in Eugene, Oregon for a conference. And it was a mess outside. They had a few inches of snow and the city was in chaos. A seasoned Montana and myself, I just shook my head and judged silently the community. But as I walked around the corner from my hotel to a local restaurant, I saw a man spit on a homeless person outside the restaurant door. And I don't know what prompted this, what happened before I showed up, and the man quickly walked off. But it was a stark moment of disgust, even cruelty, to my mind. The homeless guy was fine, he asked for a few dollars, and he moved on too. But as I sat at the bar, the moment stuck with me, a small, monstrous act. Then when the local, two seats over, struck up a gin-slurred conversation with me, he realized that I spent my days thinking about literature, and he scoffed. Waste of time, he said. So this, it seems to me, both instances are perfect encapsulations of how some parts of contemporary American society view art and each other, and a contemplative life more generally, against a narrative of economic productivity and consumption that links time with work, associates slow thinking with waste or excess, and distracts us from the cruelty just outside the door. If we're not considering our relationship to others, witnessing monstrous behavior and tracing its source, what are we doing? And if the history of storytelling, of which Western literature is a subset, has at its core the question of obligation to others, human and non-human, of telling and listening to stories, why aren't we more explicitly as a society turning to literature to make sense of the cruelty and suffering that we have more and more access to in our hypervisual 24/7 news cycle? I didn't say any of that to the guy at the bar. I nodded and ordered another beer, and he proceeded to fall off the end of the bar a few minutes later. So I promise that this moment has bearing on what I'm going to talk about today, but I had to get that out. We'll come back to it. Thank you for listening. Anyway, the occasion of this lecture is to commemorate the 200th anniversary of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And I want to explore the legacies today of the novel's overlooked subtitle, The Modern Prometheus. I want us to think about why the Prometheus myth, which I'll explain in a minute, is so enduring in literature and film. In other words, what does Prometheus teach us about being human and being monstrous in our own rapidly changing technological age? I'm going to suggest that in Frankenstein, and in other stories about the limits of human experience, in strange obsessions, horrifying creatures, and eerie sci-fi worlds, monsters, paradoxically, tell us more about ourselves than we can. The plan is this. I'm going to talk for about 40 minutes, approximately, and then I've invited three of my students, my best students, to come up so that we can talk about their perspectives on Frankenstein and about the Prometheus myth, to hear not just my voice, but many voices, essentially to waste your time this evening with an excess of slow thinking. So, that's Frankenstein. Who is this Prometheus? Back in ancient Greece, Prometheus was a transitional figure caught between two worlds, one of force and one of justice. Between the old gods called Titans, like Cronus, and the new gods called Olympians, like Zeus. At first, Prometheus fights against the Titans with Zeus for a new world order. Then he creates humankind from clay and steals fire from Zeus to give to the humans. Zeus is not happy. He punishes Prometheus for his crime, chaining him to a rock as an eagle eats his liver day after day. One of the most famous accounts of the Prometheus myth comes from the Greek tragedian Aeschylus, somewhere between 480 and 410 BCE. The play Prometheus Bound depicts Prometheus being chained to a mountain as he explains his outrage over his treatment by Zeus. Prometheus talks about the gifts he's given man, especially all-fashioning fire, as he calls it, but also writing, math, metallurgy, agriculture. Thanks to Prometheus, humans no longer have to foresee their imminent death and are free to develop their potential beyond animal existence. The play ends with Prometheus defiantly telling the audience to witness my suffering before being hit by Zeus's lightning bolt and buried under rocks. A key aspect of Aeschylus's tragic version of the Prometheus myth is his emphasis on suffering, both Promethean and human, because for Aeschylus, life is suffering, and learning is itself a form of suffering, of being painfully aware of the cruelty that's preceded you and continues around you, of being conscious of your own mortality and actively anticipating your death. And finally, of being sensitive to your relative inconsequence to an indifferent universe. Fun stuff. At the conclusion of Prometheus Bound, the audience is left with a number of questions. How do we judge Prometheus? Is he a hero, unjustly or cruelly and unusually punished? Or should he rightfully suffer the consequences of his actions? And what does it mean to witness Prometheus's suffering anyway? These are the unresolved problems the play raises, and they've been taken up in a variety of artistic media in the past 2.5 millennia. Side note, some recent productions of Prometheus Bound have been set in federal prisons and performed by inmates as actors to explore these issues of justice and punishment. But the dominant theme that Prometheus presents to Western literature is how technologies, from fiery torches to warm hearths to the circuit boards in our iPhones, shape the contours of what it means to be human, distinguishing us from animals and providing the material infrastructure for civilization. And now we can turn to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the modern Prometheus, to see how Shelley revises the Promethean theme for a soon-to-be modern world at the beginning of the 19th century. So in 1816, Mary Shelley and her husband Percy spent a summer in Switzerland. The weather was terrible for months, and it was caused by the global atmospheric effects of a massive 1815 volcanic eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia. The weather made the couple and their friends stay inside all summer, prompting a ghost story contest. Mary Shelley wrote The Beginning of Frankenstein that summer, and their family doctor, John Polidori, wrote the origin story of The Vampire, another classic monster. Lord Byron, also there, wrote a related story about how vampires disguise themselves in society. It's intriguing that the origin story of Frankenstein is framed by extreme geological changes that have planetary effects on climate, an idea that we're going to come back to. But at the very least, we can say that romantic literary figures like Shelley and Byron were obsessed with extremes and how the non-human world impinges on us even when we think we're in control, from volcanoes and hurricanes in their time to viruses and microbes in ours. Frankenstein is an example of what's called Gothic literature, a look at the extremes of human behavior and perception, the unexplainable and perhaps supernatural phenomena that don't quite fit into easy rationalization or scientific category. The Gothic often portrays the creation of monsters, where a specific monster represents a site for writers and readers to explore the fears and anxiety of a culture at the time. My students hear this a lot, so they're familiar. Scary things not acceptable in polite company, but also, and always simultaneously, are fantasies. Erotic, unmentionable desires not acceptable in polite company. We are fascinated and disgusted by monsters. Our job as readers is to think about what fantasies, desires, fears, anxieties does a given monstrous body express? What categories does it cross, confuse, or resist? And to think, who decides what counts as a monster? Who polices the definition of monstrosity? Who benefits? Many of you have read Frankenstein, but if you haven't, the original story is much different than you might remember or expect. No green monsters with bolts on their heads. Instead, the novel has a fairly complex narrative structure. And up here, I've tried to diagram it. I don't know if you can read it all, but essentially, the outer circle is the novel as a whole. The next level is the frame narrative of Robert Walton, who's an explorer whose letters back to his sister in England are it's basically the way that the story is given to the reader, because Robert Walton encounters Victor Frankenstein, on these ice floes in the Arctic Ocean. You're like, what? I totally forgot about that. And then he tells Walton his story, and then inside of Victor's story, the creature is allowed to tell his story. And inside of that story, there's another story of the safety of the DeLacy cabin, where the creature learns to read and to write eventually. So we're going to talk more about, when we get to the student panel, that nested narrative structure. This structure allows Shelley to layer the Promethean theme, that arrow there, in fascinating ways. Think about Robert Walton, the man whose letters to his sister about his encounter with Victor provide a scaffold for the novel. Robert Walton has the ardent curiosity of a fearless explorer, despite his father's objections. He's transgressing his creator's wishes by seeking out the limit of where humans have gone before. When asked why he's going to the Arctic, he says, because it's there. Similarly, Victor's early ambition is to go beyond the limits of science and medicine, to banish disease from the human frame and to render man invulnerable to any but a violent death. Both Walton and Victor are Promethean characters, crossing geographic and medical boundaries to give gifts of knowledge to future generations. And although I don't have time to get into this too much today, the historical scientific context of early 19th century England had a big influence on Shelley, visible in her depiction of Victor's scientific education and his approach to creating the creature. For example, early 19th century scientists Sir Humphrey Davy and Erasmus Darwin, who was Charles Darwin's grandfather, believed that all matter was animated by a vitalist spark of life, so that new life could be generated spontaneously out of dead matter. This helps to explain Victor's hunting through graveyards and morgues for corpses that he could stitch together and eventually animate. And Humphrey Davy saw science itself as creative, against the theological dangers of such a term, God only can create life. For Davy, the pursuit of scientific knowledge was a kind of art. So in this time period, Prometheus became associated with creative and artistic processes. And Mary Shelley's mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, a famous champion for women's rights and education, goes so far as to call Prometheus a revolutionary and a genius in A Vindication of the Rights of Women. It's also significant that Wollstonecraft died soon after giving birth to Mary Shelley, and that Shelley's guilt and anxiety over the relation between her birth and her mother's death are deeply woven into Frankenstein. For instance, when Victor finally gives the creature life, he immediately feels shame and horror, dreams about his cousin and dead mother, and then runs away and passes out. But the primary Promethean theme in the novel becomes Victor's relationship to his creation, his creature. In a stroke of genius, Shelley allows the creature to confront his creator, and the creature argues passionately that Victor has a duty to him. The creature asks Victor to listen to me, hear my tale. Victor concedes that he does have the duties of a creator toward his creature and consents to listen. And so here Shelley seems to be imposing or proposing the ethical dimension of storytelling, of listening to someone else's perspective, being silent, truly hearing the voice of another. And as the creature tells his story, he highlights his own education, reading first a history book, which is Ruins of Empire by Constantin-François de Chassé-Boeuf, Comte de Vannes. As a result, the creature is led to ask a crucial question. Was man indeed at once so powerful, virtuous, magnificent, yet so virtuous and base, base meaning demeaned, violent, cruel? Being confronted with the historical violence of the human species, the creature points out all our monstrosities, our hypocrisies and ironies, the ideals never quite lived up to. Like Aeschylus, the creature's sorrow only increased with knowledge. And indeed, Victor doesn't ever live up to the empathy he shows by listening to the creature. The rest of the novel is a series of miscommunication, broken promises, and failed bonds between creator and created. The creature basically ends up murdering everyone Victor knows and loves, and Victor chases him to the ends of the earth, the Arctic. But in many ways, the creature is more human than Victor, more human than the human. He's more sensitive, at least at first, and in the end, more violent and vengeful. Even getting a kind of cruel pleasure in tormenting Victor, leading him to the Arctic, and where Victor encounters Walton, tells a story, and then dies. So Shelley appears to be saying that we need the monster to see our own monstrosity. For the creature is, paradoxically, fully human and fully monstrous. But because Victor and the creature are two sides of the same ego-centered personality, Frankenstein suggests that we can become truly human only by admitting our monstrosity, potential and actual. This admission, however, violates a number of our senses of self. For example, it challenges the idea that each of us is a discrete individual with our own special personality and special individuated body. Our shared monstrous nature cuts across all these differences. It also calls into question our membership in communities whose very existence is predicated on difference from others, racial, national, political. But the novel eventually hints at the notion that empathy, even empathy, listening to someone else's story, simply isn't enough and can lead to condescension, oh, poor thing, or self-satisfied cliches. You know, really, we're all the same. Those reactions forestall action at all. And they divert our attention from cruelty, normalizing it and masking it. So I've used the term paradox today, which is a nice segue to the title of the lecture, Prometheus Paradox. But what does that mean? A paradox is a statement so surprisingly self-contradictory as to provoke us into seeking another sense in which it might be true. Paradoxes challenge our habits of thought by affirming two apparently contradictory conditions or thoughts at once. So let's lay out some ideas and trace some paradoxes. Number one, Prometheus stole fire from the gods to give it to humans. Number two, from the gods' perspective, Prometheus was a monster who overstepped his bounds and was punished for it, restoring the natural order. Number three, from the human perspective, Prometheus was a god who created the very category of the human apart from the animal, because fire, the first true technology, gave humans warmth, protection from predators, cooking, light, hunting techniques, the development of tools and weapons, and the origin of art and writing. Four, from his own perspective, Prometheus sacrificed himself for humans and was unjustly punished for introducing modern ways of thinking into the world. But the paradox isn't that Prometheus is both monster and god, destroyer of old systems and creator of new ones, short-sighted experimenter and sacrificial visionary. The paradox is that the human species, created through fire, now has the capacity to destroy itself. The technologies that create the human world, a stable world, a world apart from animal hunger and violence, a world apart from the rhythms of sunrise and sunset, a world of representation, memory, in writing and art, are exactly the things that destroy those worlds. Suddenly, the technological supplements the human, becomes forever entwined with the human and the human's own potential to create, a sort of double helix of techno-human reproduction. All of this Prometheus gave, and thus the paradox is that Prometheus, both sufferer and inflictor, feels the cruelty that he introduced into the world. But what does it mean to say that Prometheus sacrificed himself for humankind? Prometheus's sacrifice lays the foundation of a kind of sacrificial thinking in human civilization, taking from Zeus the idea that the bad other must be punished, banished, executed, so that we know the good. We see this in Judeo-Christian traditions from Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac, for example, and the idea of sacrifice, the one for the many, that structures many monster narratives from Batman's relationship to the Joker in something like The Dark Knight, and zombie apocalypse films, which often have this kind of utilitarian ethics built into it, where you'll sacrifice one to save this larger community. But back to Prometheus. Though humans may appreciate Prometheus and curse that damn Zeus, we've unconsciously adopted in our civilization Zeus's sacrificial logic, the logic of punishment. By introducing fire, Prometheus ironically makes us aware of the original sameness between human and animal, because through fire, we're abruptly conscious of our modern difference and distance from animals. While we hang on to the difference, the logic of sacrifice, think again about animal sacrifices across religious traditions, even dietary restrictions, we immediately ignore or forget the sameness we share with animals, that we are all material bodies made of bones, flesh, and organs from evolutionary processes over million-year spans. We keep repeating the myth of difference again and again. The myth endures because it has so many layers. It's about obsession with creation and destruction, about the limits of scientific knowledge, about the creator's duty to the created, about punishment, consequence, and finally, in 2019, about our willingness to sacrifice central aspects of humanness in the name of technological progress. To trace all these layers, we're going to move quickly through the 19th and 20th centuries to arrive at our contemporary moment, where Prometheus today and Promethean fire has transformed into artificial intelligence and our creations have perhaps begun to punish us. So let's start with everyone's favorite transcendental American philosopher, Ralph Waldo Emerson. In his essay History, Emerson helpfully summarizes my lecture today. What a range of meanings and what perpetual pertinence has the story of Prometheus. Emerson's philosophical enemy, my good friend Herman Melville, also draws on the myth in Moby Dick when his narrator Ishmael compares monomaniacal Captain Ahab to Prometheus. Ahab is a man so obsessed with capturing the white whale that ate his leg that his whole way of thinking has been affected. He is the intellectual Prometheus, a man with an obsession that tyrannizes over all other concerns, a creation that torments the creator. But more dramatically than any other figure in the 20th century, J. Robert Oppenheimer, the architect of the first nuclear bomb during the Manhattan Project, would carry the repercussions of that Ahab Prometheus to their most destructive. Oppenheimer, a physicist whose definitive biography, not incidentally, is American Prometheus, it's really good, check it out, 2005, grappled with the consequences of his creation. Oppenheimer was thinking through what it meant to create this nuclear weapon that could destroy worlds. Reflecting on the first test of the bomb at Trinity site, on July 16, 1945, Oppenheimer claimed to have been reminded of a phrase from the Bhagavad Gita, a Hindu epic scripture from the 4th century BC. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Another side note, you can see it up there, it's not surprising that the most popular monster figure in the 1950s was Godzilla, a creature created out of an atomic explosion that haunts humankind for its nuclear sins. This new planetary power for destruction of entire worlds, we see in various ways beyond even military capabilities in the 20th and 21st centuries. In the development, for instance, of petrochemicals, plastics, radiation materials, and anthropogenic minerals, that is, minerals that are produced only by human beings. In the acidification of oceans, global warming, the human imprint on the planet is undeniable. We may have reached our fully Promethean age, an age of integrated technology, where we now have the power not just over the Earth, but also over the creation of life and perhaps the threat of death. I'm thinking here about bio and nanotechnologies, as well as the rapid advances in artificial intelligence, a dominant theme in literature and film in the past 20 years. This previously unforeseen influence over life and death carries implications that are almost unimaginable, and then these things get expressed in a variety of ways, and I would say primarily five: denial, anxiety, horror, dystopian prophecy, or utopian hope. And it's very difficult to conceptualize the human's relation to planetary existence without falling into cliches or retreating to the security of faith, whether religious or technological. So most of us don't simply think about it at all. But our culture nevertheless produces narratives that obliquely address these fears and anxieties in the safe space of fiction and film. So I want to conclude today with a look at two films at the margins of culture. Two sci-fi horror films whose dark themes and gross imagery are not going to compete with the shiny Marvel universe at the box office or make dinner conversation after the film easy. It's hard to talk about chest-bursting aliens over apple pie with a drunk uncle from Eugene, Oregon. I'm referring to the latest installments of Ridley Scott's Alien franchise, films that are deeply unsettling and scary, precisely because they have something to say about our own monstrous natures, about our proximity to animal life that we'd rather not admit. I'm arguing here that looking at the margins of culture to The Castaway and The Gross Out reveals the center all the more clearly. So bear with me as we look at some disgusting aliens. But first, before we do this, I need to go back to 1960 for a second, to JFK's famous speech to the Democratic National Convention, where he talks about the exploration of the solar system as the new frontier. With the 19th century mythic American frontier of Western wilderness already tamed, JFK tells us, we should look to the stars. We stand on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unfulfilled hopes and dreams, a frontier of unknown opportunities and beliefs in peril. Beyond that frontier are uncharted areas of science and space, unsolved problems of peace and war, unconquered problems of ignorance and prejudice, unanswered questions of poverty and surplus. So it's interesting that while Robert Walton sought the unexplored Arctic, while Victor Frankenstein crossed the boundary between life and death, while Ahab hunted the whale to the unknown depths of the Pacific, and while Oppenheimer harnessed the energy of the atomic, Kennedy frames the new frontier as galactic exploration beyond our planet. Beyond our planet that would be suddenly visible from space after Apollo 8 in 1968. Such planetary consciousness, from nuclear weapons to photographs of Earth taken beyond its atmosphere, gets absorbed into popular culture and expressed, unsurprisingly, in the burst of science fiction and space films of the 1960s and 70s. Think Lost in Space, Star Wars, Star Trek, and 2001 A Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece. And then in 1979, there was Ridley Scott's Alien, which I see as a major event in science fiction horror, but also in film history. So before we start, I want to reiterate that we should treat this film and others like it carefully, moving past the outrageous and fantastic premises to take seriously the metaphoric and philosophical weight that lurks beneath the glossy sci-fi veneer. All of the aliens put the human on the defensive. They're not in charge, stumbling through a dark world of forces beyond our knowledge and control. They become the hunted, animals at the mercy of predators. technologies are ineffective here. For example, in the first Alien, Ellen Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver, and her crew are in deep space on a corporate ship when they detect a distress call from a random moon. They investigate, are exposed to an alien organism that quickly grows and hunts them in the ship. We later find out that in this new frontier of space, the company, which is called Wayland Enterprises, actually wants the organism for its own uses. It wants what the alien wants, to extract resources and reproduce. There's a lot going on in terms of mothers and female characters, and not just Ripley here as a badass hero, but also the computer system that monitors and controls the ship called the Nostromo, which is a reference to a Joseph Conrad novel. We won't get into that. But the computer system is called Mother. And there's also the womb and vaginal imagery that dominate the film. We could spend a long time with these images highlighting how Alien plays with Western culture's repression of female agency, transforming it into caricatures of monstrous femininity, and how patriarchal unease with the power of female reproduction and birth is both replicated by and subverted by the gaze of the camera, but that's all I'll say. To give one short example, let's look at the central horror scene in the film, the one that famously depicts the culmination of the alien's life cycle, the chestburster. One version of the alien is that face hugger on the left there, if you can see, that implants an embryo inside the human host and then phallically bursts out of the chest, a kind of inverted birth that blurs acts of destruction and creation, male and female. This trans-species penetration, plus the overall goriness, is one of the things that makes the alien so uncomfortable for viewers. More philosophically, the chest-bursting alien is a version of the eagle that feeds on Prometheus. The punishment for overstepping our human boundaries and a reduction of our body to its viscera, where inside becomes outside and our animal flesh is literally on display for the camera. And then there's the full-grown alien, a grotesque hybrid of human and animal, slimy, double-mouthed, and whose purpose only, it seems, is to kill, find a host, and reproduce. But these characteristics are also a source of its elegance, its purity, as the ship's robot Ash phrases it. That's Ash. The audience doesn't know that Ash is an android until the end. And he's even in the earlier image here, in the center. And when we realize that he's been programmed by the company to capture and study the alien, we realize that he's also the one who breaks quarantine procedures and looses the terror on the Nostromo. It's interesting also that we don't suspect him to be synthetic at first, and that because he is programmed, a program creation himself, he shares more common ground with the aliens than the humans. He admires the clarity of the aliens' bioengineering, not diluted by morality or concepts of cruelty, a pure animality that ruthlessly eats Prometheus because, simply, that's what he does. Ash's beheaded corpse, or beheading here, exposes not blood, but synthetic white goo, which is a kind of abject, cybernetic, seminal fluid that links him with the mother alien's constantly dripping saliva that you'll see in Alien 2 and other more blockbuster versions of the franchise. Anyway, while the original Alien is a masterpiece, updating the Promethean myth from Aeschylus to Shelley into the late 20th century, I would argue that Ridley Scott's next chapter, which comes more than 30 years later, says even more about where we are in 2019. And I know I'm running out of time here, but I want to introduce Prometheus using two clips. So I'm going to dim the lights a little bit so we can see here. So I should say, this clip was actually not in the film. It was part of the marketing campaign and advertising for the film. So it's this small clip that was sent around YouTube to promote Prometheus the film. And this, he'll be introducing himself as a character, Peter Wayland. Remember, Wayland Enterprises, Wayland Industries. He's introducing himself at a kind of TED Talk in 2023.
Eponymously of Arabia, but very much an Englishman. Favored pinching a burning match between his fingers to put it out. When asked by his colleague, William Potter, to reveal his trick, how is it he so effectively extinguished the flame without hurting himself whatsoever, Lawrence just smiled and said, "The trick, Potter, is not minding it hurts. The fire that danced at the end of that match was a gift from the Titan Prometheus, a gift that he stole from the gods when Prometheus was caught and brought to justice for his theft. The gods, well, you might say they overreact a little. The poor man was tied to a rock as an eagle ripped through his belly and ate his liver over and over, day after day, ad infinitum. All because he gave us fire, our first true piece of technology. Fire. 100,000 BC, stone tools. 4,000 BC, the wheel. 9th century AD, gunpowder. Bit of a game changer, that one. 19th century, Eureka, the light bulb. 20th century, the automobile, television, nuclear weapons, spacecraft, internet. 21st century, biotech, nanotech, fusion and fission and M theory. And that was just the first decade. We are now 3 months into the year of our Lord, 2023. At this moment in our civilization, we can create cybernetic individuals who, in just a few short years, will be completely indistinguishable from us. Which leads to an obvious conclusion. We are the gods now. For those of you who know me, you will be aware by now that my ambition is unlimited. You know that I will settle for nothing short of greatness, or I will die trying. For those of you who do not yet know me, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Peter Weyland. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to change the world.
Back up here. Okay. So, I'll say a few things about that clip, and then I'll introduce the next one. So in this clip, the Elon Musk-esque futurist icon, Peter Weyland, invokes the Prometheus myth as a sympathetic figure. Prometheus's gift is a blessing. When any negative consequences of technology, any pain of progress, should simply be endured for the greater good. Our Promethean reliance on technology means that for Weyland, human mastery over the planet is noble. The final stage in human potential that will allow us to move beyond our planet into other frontiers of knowledge. Now we can build better worlds, which is the logo of the corporation. But taken as a whole, the film does not accept Weyland's techno-optimism and critiques it in interesting ways. And so now the second clip is more about how Weyland sets the wheels in motion for the exploratory journey of a ship called the Prometheus.
Weyland Corporation, building better worlds.
Hello, friends. My name is Peter Weyland. I am your employer. I am recording this 22 June 2091. And if you're watching it, you have reached your destination. And I am long dead. May I rest in peace. There's a man sitting with you today. His name is David, and he is the closest thing to a son I will ever have. Unfortunately, he's not human. He will never grow old, and he will never die. And yet he is unable to appreciate these remarkable gifts, for that would require the one thing that David will never have, a soul. I have spent my entire lifetime contemplating the questions, where do we come from? What is our purpose? What happens when we die? And I have finally found two people who have convinced me they're on the verge of answering them. Doctors Holloway and Shaw, if you would please stand. As far as you're concerned, they're both in charge. The Titan Prometheus wanted to give mankind equal footing with the gods. For that, he was cast from Olympus. Well, my friends, the time has finally come for his return. Doctors, please.
That's basically it. And it got cut off a little bit earlier when Peter Weyland is introducing himself at the TED Talk. He's referencing Lawrence of Arabia and this idea that the trick is not minding that it hurts, right? To endure that kind of pain. What happens in the film is that the crew of the Prometheus that you saw there are sent by Weyland to investigate whether human civilization was potentially created by another alien civilization. And they discover a crashed alien ship on a remote planet. On the ship, they find a mysterious black goo that they realize creates the alien's parasite-like indifferent hosts. This silly premise aside, more important is Weyland's obsession with origins, with where we come from. He doesn't accept Darwinian chance and mutation, and the film investigates his hope and our hope for design, for clear answers. And so the characters discover that an alien race called the Engineers actually did make the human beings. The goo and the aliens are their bioweapons, their destroyer of worlds, as Oppenheimer would have put it. Like Victor Frankenstein, the Engineers, the ultimate Prometheans, turn out, however, to be no better than us. The central driver of the film, however, is not a human, but like in the first Alien, a robot. Weyland creates the robot David that we saw in that clip, and like Frankenstein's creature, David is interested in the responsibility of the creator to the created. And crucially, David is the one to introduce the bioweapon alien goo onto the ship, which creates chaos and the kind of horror chase that we're used to in these alien films. He, like Milton's rebellious Satan, refuses the authority of his creator. So the monster of Prometheus is David. But as we are Weyland, David is our creation, our Promethean consequence. And note also the resonances of David's name to Michelangelo's David, the image of male marble perfection, plus the biblical intertext of the underdog prophet David who would be king. David introduces destruction into the Prometheus because he can, just like he was created because we could. So here we have a Prometheus created by a Prometheus punishing the Prometheus. The idea of simply doing things because we can is why Victor created the creature in the first place and why Prometheus gave fire to man. Because they could. And maybe this is the dead center of the Promethean paradox, a totally unsatisfying answer, a gap in the core question of existence that somehow does go far in explaining the nature of cruelty. At the heart of the human is the absent reason, the monstrous capacity, the looking away from the face of another necessary for viciousness. To destroy, to become death, to become alien is a kind of centripetal or inward driving force of the human. And this is the uncomfortable lesson of the Prometheus paradox for all of us. David's fascistic tendencies, this philosophy of destroying to create anew, gets even more complicated in the last film so far. There's probably going to be another one. And the last film was Alien Covenant, and I'm going to end here. Alien Covenant picks up 10 years after the Promethean drama when a new ship, the Covenant, gets a distress signal from a hidden planet. They check it out and encounter David, that robot, living in the ruins of the Engineer's civilization. Turns out that David and the doctor who survive from the Prometheus, named Elizabeth Shaw, they take the alien craft from the Prometheus planet and navigate it back to the Engineer's home planet. Soon after, David unleashes the alien bioweapons and destroys the whole civilization. David, the only survivor, spends a decade experimenting with the alien goo, trying to create himself the perfect alien. The main conceit is that David's AI system is out of whack. And so an upgraded version named Walter, you can see him on the left there, arrives. David and Walter talk about creation and destruction, freedom and duty. This is incredibly done by Michael Fassbender, who plays both David and Walter. And it's spooky to watch a human actor playing two AIs discussing the nature of creativity. Walter is not programmed or code corrupted like David. He's the improved version. More robotic, predictable, tamer. While David, on the other hand, makes mistakes, composes his own music and experiments in his own lab. And this is how Alien Covenant updates the Promethean myth in provocative ways. At first, we see Wayland as the Frankenstein Promethean figure. Then David becomes Dr. Frankenstein, a reordering of the Promethean myth, where the human creator, Wayland, creates the non-human creature, David, who in turn becomes the creator of the non-human creature, the mother alien, by torturing his human creator, Elizabeth Shaw, who's the doctor, who's a kind of proxy of Wayland. Complicated. And in the end, David destroys that robot double Walter, hides his engineered alien embryos on the Covenant for Future Terrors, the sequel that will come out in 2021. The creatures always escape, all monsters escape. Until next time. The technological supplement can never be lost, destroyed, or forgotten. Although it's interesting that often fire is the only thing that can kill the monster, usually involving suicide. Frankenstein's creature, for example, tells Walton that he's going to burn himself alive to prevent future suffering. And in Alien 3, those of you who are familiar with the franchise, Ripley jumps into a fiery furnace to kill the mother alien that's inside of her. You also see it in things like Terminator 2 and other movies. Anyway. But I think what's most fascinating about Alien Covenant is that it uncoils the Promethean myth until the story becomes less about punishment and more about the act of creation and what happens when the createds create themselves. Here we have engineers creating humans, creating robots, creating aliens. It is through the creative medium of filmmaking and cinematography or light writing, or reflections of fire on a cave wall, that we're able to glimpse these spirals of creation, reproduction, and artistic representation. If David, and not the alien, is the real monster, then he is also, like Frankenstein's creature, more human than human. He's the most destructive because he's also the most creative. David's monstrosity, his indifference to suffering, his willingness to destroy, to create, is what makes him uncomfortably human, and thus uncannily disturbing. He's too close for comfort visually and philosophically. For he, like all monsters, finally turns to us and asks, why have we created him? Because we can. And in this moment of facing David, facing ourselves, maybe we see some glimmer of hope, a terrifying reminder of our obligation to the created, even the non-human, animal, alien, other. Even the possibility that we might reorder the logic of sacrifice and cruelty that has for so long defined us as a species. Through the cinema, itself a gift from Prometheus, we are startled to see not just ourselves and the monsters, but the extent of our obligations to what we have created, to ourselves, our planet, and all the monsters that make us human. Thank you.